The child described the final attack, when the animal, its thick ruff of black mane erect, had rushed in at the family, grunting and roaring. Her mother had only time enough to push the girl into the lowest branch of the mupane before the lion was on them. Her father had stood gallantly to meet it, and thrust his long spear into its chest. But the spear had snapped, and the lion leapt upon him and tore out his bowels with a single swipe of curved yellow claws. Then it had sprung at the mother as she was attempting to climb into the mupane, and hooked its claws into her back and dragged her down. In her small bird-like voice, the child described how the lion had eaten the corpses of her parents, down to the heads and feet and hands, while she watched from the upper branches. It had taken 2 days over the grisly feast, at intervals pausing to lick the spear wound in its shoulder. On the third day, it had attempted to reach the child, ripping at the trunk of the mupane and roaring horribly. At last it had given up and wandered away into the forest, limping heavily with the wound. Even then the child had been too terrified to leave her perch, and she had clung there until at last she had passed out with exhaustion and grief, exposure and fear. While she was relating all this, the camp servants were refueling the jeep and preparing supplies for the journey to Rundu. Shaza left as soon as this was done, taking the boys with him. He would not leave them in the camp while there was a wounded man-eating lion roaming in the vicinity. They drove through the night, recrossing their jerry-built bridge and retracing their tracks until the following morning they intersected the main Rundu road, and that afternoon they finally arrived, dusty and exhausted, at the airstrip. The blue and silver mosquito that Shaza had left at Hani Mine was parked in the shade of the trees at the edge of the strip, and the company pilot and the doctor were squatting under the wing, waiting patiently. Shaza gave the child into the doctor's care and went quickly through the pile of urgent documents and messages that the pilot had brought with him. He scribbled out orders and replies to these, and a long letter of instruction to David Abrams. When the mosquito took off again, the sick girl went with them. She would receive first-rate medical attention at the mine hospital, and Shaza would decide what to do with the little orphan once she was fully recovered. The return to the safari camp was more leisurely than the outward journey, and over the next few days the excitement of the lion adventure was forgotten in the other absorbing concerns of safari life, not least of which was the business of Gary's first kill. Bad luck now combined with his lack of coordination and poor marksmanship to cheat him of this experience that he hungered for more than any other, while on the other hand, Sean succeeded in providing meat for the camp at every attempt. "What we are going to do is practice a little more on the pigeons," Shaza decided, after one of Gary's least successful outings. In the evenings, the flocks of fat green pigeons came flighting in to feast on the wild figs in the grove beside the waterhole. Shaza took the boys down as soon as the sun lost its heat, and placed them in the hides they had built of saplings and dried grass, each hide far enough from the next and carefully sighted, so that there was no danger of a careless shot causing an accident. This afternoon Shaza put Sean into a hide at the near end of the glade, with Michael, who had once again declined to take an active part in the sport, to keep him company and pick up the fallen birds for him. Then Shaza and Gary set off together for the far side of the grove. Shaza was leading with Gary, following him, as the game path twisted between the thick yellow trunks of the figs. Their bark was yellow and scaly as the skin of a giant reptile, and the bunches of figs grew directly on the trunks rather than on the tips of the branches. Beneath the trees, the undergrowth was tangled and thick, and the game path was so twisted that they could see only a short distance ahead. The light was poor this late in the afternoon, with the branches meeting overhead. Shaza came round another turn, and the lion was in the game path, walking straight towards him only 50 paces away. In the instant he saw it, Shaza realized that it was the man-eater. It was a huge beast, the biggest he had ever seen in a lifetime of hunting. It stood higher than his waist, and its mane was coal-black, long and shaggy and dense, shading to blue-grey down the beast's flanks and back. It was an old lion, its flat face crisscrossed with scars. Its mouth was gaping, panting with pain as it limped towards him, and he saw that the spear wound in the shoulder had mortified. the raw flesh crimson as a rose petal, and the fur around the wound wet and slicked down where the lion had been licking it. The flies swarmed to the wound, irritating and stinging, and the lion was in a vicious mood, sick with age and pain. It lifted its dark and shaggy head, and Shaza looked into the pale yellow eyes and saw the agony and blind rage they contained. "Gary," he said urgently, "walk backwards. Don't run, but get out of here." And without looking around, he swung the sling of the rifle off his shoulder. The lion dropped into a crouch, its long tail, with the black bush of hair at the tip, lashed back and forth like a metronome, as it gathered itself for the charge, and its yellow eyes fastened on Shaza, a focus for all its rage. Shaza knew there would be time for only a single shot, for it would cover the ground between them in a blazing blur of speed. The light was too bad and the range was too far for that single shot to be conclusive. He would let it come in to where there could be no doubt, and the big 300-grain soft-nosed bullet from the Holland and Holland would shatter its skull and blow its brains to a mush. The lion launched into its charge, keeping low to the earth, snaking it and grunting as it came, gut-shaking bursts of sound through the gaping jaws lined with long yellow fangs. Shaza braced himself and brought up the rifle. But before he could fire, there was the sharp crack of the little Winchester beside him, and the lion collapsed in the middle of his charge, going down head-first and cartwheeling, flopping over on its back to expose the soft butter-yellow fur of its belly, its limbs stretching and relaxing, the long curved talons in its huge paws slowly retracting into the pads, the pink tongue lolling out of its open jaws, and the rage dying out of those pale yellow eyes. From the tiny bullet hole between its eyes, a thin serpent of blood crawled down to dribble from its brow into the dirt beneath it. In astonishment, Shaza lowered his rifle and looked around. Beside him stood Gary, his head at the level of Shaza's lowest rib, the little Winchester still at his shoulder, his face set and deadly pale, and his spectacles glinting in the gloom beneath the trees.
You killed it, Shaza said stupidly. You stood your ground and you killed it.
Shaza walked forward slowly and stooped over the carcass of the man-eater. He shook his head in amazement and then looked back at his son. Gary had not yet lowered the rifle, but he was beginning now to tremble with delayed terror. Shaza dipped his finger into the blood that dribbled from the wound in the man-eater's forehead, then walked back to where Gary stood. He painted the ritual stripes on the boy's forehead and cheeks. "Now you are a man, and I'm proud of you," he said. Slowly the colour flushed back into Gary's cheeks, and his lips stopped trembling, and then his face began to glow. It was an expression of such pride and unutterable joy that Shaza felt his throat close up and tears sting his eyelids. Every servant came from the camp to view the man-eater and to hear Shaza describe the details of the hunt. Then, by the light of the lanterns, they carried the carcass back. While the skinners went to work, the men sang the song of the hunter in Gary's honour. Sean was torn between incredulous admiration and deepest envy of his brother, while Michael was fulsome in his praises. Gary refused to wash the dried lion's blood from his face, when at last, well after midnight, Shaza finally ordered them to bed. At breakfast, he still wore the crusted stripes of blood on his beaming, grubby face, and Michael read aloud the heroic poem he had written in Gary's honour. It began, "With lungs to blast the skies with sound, and breath hot as the blacksmith's forge, eyes as yellow as the moon's full round, and the lust on human flesh to gorge." Shaza hid a smile at the laboured rhyming, and at the end applauded as loudly as the rest of them. After breakfast they all trooped out to watch the skinners dressing out the lion skin, pegging it fur side down in the shade, scraping away the yellow subcutaneous fat, and rubbing in coarse salt and alum. "Well, I still think it died of a heart attack." Sean could suppress his envy no longer, and Gary rounded on him furiously. "We all know what a clever dick you are, and when you shoot your first lion, then you can come and talk to me, smarty pants. All you're good for is a few little old impala." It was a long speech, delivered in white heat, and Gary never stumbled nor stuttered once. It was the first time Shaza had seen him stand up to Sean's casual bullying, and he waited for Sean to assert his authority. For seconds it hung in the balance. He could see Sean weighing it up, deciding whether to tweak the spikes of hair at Gary's temple or to give him a chestnut down the ribs. He could see also that Gary was ready for it, his fist clenched and his lips set in a pale, determined line. Suddenly Sean grinned that charming smile. "Only kidding," he announced airily, and turned back to admire the tiny bullet hole in the skull. "Wow, right between the eyes." It was a peace offering. Gary looked bemused and uncertain. It was the first time that he had forced Sean to back down, and he wasn't able immediately to grasp that he had succeeded. Shaza stepped up and put his arm around Gary's shoulders. "Do you know what I'm going to do, champ? I'm going to have the head fully mounted for the wall in your room, with eyes and everything," he said. For the first time, Shaza was aware that Gary had developed hard little muscles in his shoulders and upper arm. He had always thought him a runt. Perhaps he had never truly looked at the child before. Then suddenly it was over. The servants were breaking camp and packing the tents and beds onto the trucks, and appallingly the prospect of the return to Feltefrieden and school loomed ahead of them. Shaza tried to keep their spirits jaunty, with stories and songs on the long drive back to Harney Mine, but with every mile the boys were more dejected. On the last day, when the hills, which the bushmen call the place of all life, floated on the horizon ahead of them, detached from the earth by the shimmering heat mirage, Shaza asked, "Have you gentlemen decided what you're going to do when you leave school?" It was an attempt to cheer them up, more than a serious inquiry. "What about you, Sean?" "I want to do what we've been doing. I want to be a hunter, an elephant hunter, like great-granduncle Sean." "Splendid," Shaza agreed. "Only problem I can see is that you're at least 60 years too late." "Well then," said Sean, "I'll be a soldier. I like shooting things." A shadow passed behind Shaza's eyes before he looked at Michael. "What about you, Mickey?" "I want to be a writer. I will work as a newspaper reporter, and in my spare time I'll write poetry and great books." "You'll starve to death, Mickey," Shaza laughed. And then he swiveled around to Gary, who was leaning over the back of the driving seat. "What about you, champ?"
"I'm going to do what you do, Dad."
"And what is it I do?" Shaza demanded with interest. "You're the chairman of Courtney Mining and Finance, and you tell everybody else what to do. That's what I want to be one day. Chairman of Courtney Mining and Finance." Shaza stopped smiling and was silent for a moment, studying the child's determined expression. Then he said lightly, "Well, then it looks as though it's up to you and me to support the elephant hunter and the poet." And he ran his hand over Gary's already unruly hair. It no longer required any effort to make an affectionate gesture towards his ugly duckling. They came singing across the rolling grasslands of Zululand, and they were 100 strong. All of them were members of the Buffaloes, and Hendrik Tabaka had carefully picked them for the special honour guard. They were the best, and all of them were dressed in tribal regalia, feathers and furs and monkey-skin capes, kilts of cow tails. They carried only fighting sticks, for the strictest tradition forbade metal weapons of any kind on this day. At the head of the column, Moses Gama and Hendrik Tabaka trotted. They also had set aside their European clothing for the occasion, and of all their men they alone wore leopard-skin cloaks, as was their noble right. Half a mile behind them rose the dust of the cattle herd. This was the Lobola, the marriage price, 200 head of prime beasts, as they had been agreed. The herd boys were all of them sons of the leading warriors who had ridden in the cattle trucks with their charges during the 300-mile journey from the Witwatersrand. In charge of the herd boys were Wellington and Raleigh Tabaka, and they had detrained the herd at Ladyburg railway station. Like their father, they had discarded their Western-style clothing for the occasion and were dressed in loincloths and armed with their fighting sticks, and they danced and called to the cattle, keeping them in a tight bunch, both of them excited and filled with self-importance by the task they had been allotted. Ahead of them rose the high escarpment beyond the little town of Ladyburg. The slopes were covered with dark forests of black wattle, and all of it was Courtney land, from where the waterfall smoked with spray in the sunlight around the great curve of the hills. All 10,000 acres of it belonged to Lady Anna Courtney, the relict of Sir Garrick Courtney and to Storm Anders, who was the daughter of General Sean Courtney. However, beyond the waterfall lay 100 choice acres of land which had been left to Sangani Dinizulu in terms of the will of General Sean Courtney, for he had been a faithful and beloved retainer of the Courtney family, as had his father, Imbijan Dinizulu, before him. The road descended the escarpment in a series of hairpin bends, and when Moses Gama shaded his eyes and stared ahead, he saw another band of warriors coming down it to meet them. They were many more in number, perhaps 500 strong. Like Moses' party, they were dressed in full regimentals, with plumes of fur and feathers on their heads and war rattles on their wrists and ankles. The two parties halted at the foot of the escarpment, and from 100 paces faced each other, though still they sang and stamped and brandished their weapons. The shields of the Zulus were matched, selected from dappled cowhides of white and chocolate brown, and the brows of the warriors that carried them were bound with strips of the same dappled hide, while their kilts and their plumes were cowtails of purest white. They made a daunting and warlike show, all big men, their bodies gleaming with sweat in the sunlight, their eyes bloodshot with dust and excitement, and the pots of millet beer they had already downed. Facing them, Moses felt his nerves crawl with a trace of the terror that these men had for 200 years inspired in all the other tribes of Africa. And to suppress it, he stamped and sang as loudly as his buffaloes, who pressed closely around him. On this, his wedding day, Moses Gama had put aside all the manners and mores of the West and slipped back easily into his African origins, and his heart pumped and thrilled to the rhythms and the pulse of this harsh continent. From the Zulu ranks opposite him sprang a champion, a magnificent figure of a man with the strip of leopard skin around his brow that declared his royal origins. He was one of Victoria Dinizulu's elder brothers, and Moses knew he was a qualified lawyer with a large practice at Ishawi, the Zululand capital. But today he was all African, fierce and threatening as he swirled in the giya, the challenge dance. He leapt and spun and shouted his own praises and those of his family, daring the world, challenging the men who faced him, while behind him his comrades drummed with their sticks on the rawhide shields, and the sound was like distant thunder, the last sound that a million victims had ever heard, the death knell of Swazi and Xhosa, of Boer and Briton, in the days when the impis of Shaka and Dingaan and Keshwayo had swept across the land from Ishandwana, the hill of the little hand, where 700 British infantry were cut down in one of the worst military reverses that England had ever suffered in Africa, to the place of weeping where the Boers named Weenen, for their grief for the women and children who died, to that same dreadful drum roll when the impis came swarming down across the Tugela River, to 1,000 other nameless and forgotten killing grounds where the lesser tribes had perished before the men of Zulu. At last the Zulu champion staggered back into the ranks, streaked with sweat and dust, his chest heaving and froth upon his lips. And now it was Moses' turn to giya. And he danced out from amongst his buffaloes and leapt shoulder high with his leopard skins swirling around him. His limbs shone like coal freshly cut from the face, and his eyes and teeth were white as mirrors flashing in the sunlight. His voice rang from the escarpment, magnified by the echoes, and though the men facing him could not understand the words, the force and meaning of them was clear, his haughty disdain evident in every gesture. They growled and pressed forward, while his own buffaloes were goaded by his example, their blood coming to the boil, ready to rush forward and join battle with their traditional foe, ready to perpetuate the bloody vendetta that had already run 100 years.